people think the military is a lot of shouting and screaming, and you can give an order and someone's got to go do it. And yeah, part of that's kind of true. But that will also tell you there's the other side of it also, and that is, you know, people don't necessarily want to go do something unless you're a good leader. You've got to be able to be a good leader to compel them to go do something that they may not normally want to go do. And that is what I consider the true essence of a leader.
Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Hello, and welcome to the Ivy Podcast. My guest today is Pitt Gibson. He is the CIO of Friendly's Restaurant. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
So Pete, I wonder if you could please take a moment to talk about your journey from being a commander in the U.S. Navy to becoming a CIO.
It was not necessarily, it was a typical industry transition shift. So I spent approximately 20 years in the Navy. I was really fortunate to be in operations. I was working on a ship. And then I went to work in the research and development labs, so forth, working on weapon systems. And I ran a program at the time, which was probably one of the best programs the Navy had, which was the U.S. Navy's Tomahawk cruise missile program and the UAV program. And then out of there, I wanted to go into a commercial career. And so I left the Navy while I had this skill set and had brand recognition, and I was picked up by IBM. And while in the Navy, I had a fairly good rank and a really great position at IBM, I started out as a project manager, and I was lucky. I got picked up in their e-commerce group, and the e-commerce group was just put together by Lou Gerstner because he didn't want every division in IBM to have their own web presence. So he did one group, and this group was just stood up, and they brought me in to run it. I did not develop it. It was a web series shop. I had the operations of running it for it. And literally, two guys before me had a mental breakdown. The guy before me said, I don't want this. And I kind of look at it, and with the strong process procedures that I had from the government side of running technology organizations, we were able to put it together. You know, it's kind of a funny story that at first, when I first got there, my boss at the time says, we're going to take a chance on you military types. I go, okay, whatever. And then 3 months later, she comes back to me and she says, where do we get more of you military types? And so then at IBM, I had a good run there, put it together. It was a fast, furious, putting together type situation. From there, I wanted to be a traditional CIO. So I got picked up by Alamo and National Car Rental to be a divisional CIO for, at that time, their car temps division in Sullivan, Ohio.
I have a question, sure. A follow-up to something you said about the military. Mm-hmm. Do folks from the military transitioning to the corporate side, do they face a challenge in getting jobs on the corporate side because of the military background? Do you think that's something that is a disadvantage to them, or have times changed?
I still see a lot of, not resistance, but I'm not sure people really understand the military. So people think the military is a lot of shouting and screaming, and you can give an order and someone's got to go do it. And yeah, part of that's kind of true. But that will also tell you there's the other side of it also, and that is, you know, people don't necessarily want to go do something unless you're a good leader. You've got to be able to be a good leader to compel them to go do something that they may not normally want to go do. And that is what I consider the true essence of a leader, is getting someone to do they wouldn't necessarily want to go do. And I find those skills and practices be very viable in a commercial career. You may not want to go develop the product that we need to go develop. How do I lead you, incentivize you, entice you? How can I get the organization to go do it? Code quality or system quality may not be where it's at. How do we lead to get that in place for what we need as an organization or what our customers need? So that I find the principles to be very sound. Often when I hear of people's, you know, I'm not sure about the military types or whatever, I find it's a very fundamental misunderstanding of what the military does. So in my last position, I had 350 civil servants working for me. And the civil servants used to have, and I'm sure they would have a saying that us military types are, because we would come in, a military officer would come in, and we're only there for 2.5 years. And so the civil servants are there for their entire life for the most part. And they would say to us, well, if we don't like what you're doing, we'll just keep our heads low for 2.5 years and another guy will come in here. And so that kind of really led you to believe that even in that sense, they weren't military, they were civil servants at the time, very bright, talented individuals. But if you could not compel them to lead or get them to engage in their work or their positions, they would just keep their heads down. The other thing that I learned out of that was, and it's really fascinating lesson for me that I still keep really top dead center, is just how important people are in technology. So as I was running this large facility, important facility for the Navy at the time, the civil servants or the associates there were making about 10% what they could have done on the outside. They could have, most of them lived in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and came over to the lab, but they usually could have taken the train from Fredericksburg, Virginia up into Washington, D.C. and really great increase their pay. But what was interesting was they had a great group of people to work with. Uh-huh. They had great engaging projects that they were working on. And it was a good culture. And that was worth about 10% in salary.
Wow. So let's talk about your transition from the military to join the corporate world, starting with your time at IBM and as you progressed. What are some of the leadership differences that you see between military compared to corporate, and how has that helped you in your career from a strategic standpoint?
I would say there are not really a lot of differences. Yes, there's more fast pace and action, but you being a leader, you being accountable, you leading, you anticipating as a leader to keep your organization out of trouble, mm-hmm. whether it be in the military or in the commercial sector, are very viable and really important to you. So I don't see it any differently. There are, of course, the differences of the military that, you know, in a order and a command, or you don't have that on the other side of it. So you do have to modify your leadership skills. But I will tell you, as you as a leader go into an organization, and it's different for every organization, because every organization has their different cultures and so forth, right. You got to take a toolbox with you. And that's what you carry with you. And in this organization, I need to do this. And in this organization, I need to do that. You as the leader have got to read and understand your organization. And then you have got to be able to apply the appropriate tools. And that is very common for the military as well as for the commercial sector.
Got it. So essentially what you're saying is there's no cookie cutter approach where just because you're a leader, whatever worked here, it's necessarily going to work here. It's very different. You have to approach it
very different.
It's based on the challenges that you're facing.
So what happened there, so when I was in charge of the organization in the government, I didn't know how to develop code. I did not know how to develop a system. They were very much, I had people that were, if you remember, operating system ADA and coding to ADA and things of that nature for a long, long time ago. I had one of the nation's leading authority on it. I had nuclear engineers. I had a whole modeling and simulation team working on stuff. I knew nothing. I was a 35-year-old, I call myself a kid at 35, a 35-year-old person, that I was just hanging on for the ride there. But I added a lot of value by understanding the organization, learning what they were doing. I learned and grew a lot myself, but I was able to grow that for another 6 years by selling an open architecture system into other parts of the government. At IBM, I took all those processes and procedures I learned there and put it into place here. At Alamo, it was Chapter 11. At Wyndham, they couldn't get an application out the door. It was a different set of tools. My biggest challenge was running an IT outsourcing company in China. Totally different work ethic and so forth. You have to understand the situation. What do you need to go do in a management system? What do you need to go do as a leader? And then at that point, you can shape and mold the organization as to where you need to go.
So it's you said you worked for an organization in China.
I did.
Are there any differences as far as leadership when you talk about corporate culture or just culture in general? Because China is a very different culture than we have here in the States. How did you find that to be over there in Asia?
Very different, but very rewarding. A very educated, hardworking workforce. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, they had the cultures and the norms that you need to deal with in that organization as well as any other organization. So there it was very bright individuals, very ambitious. The middle class was emerging in China when I was there. And this was about 2010, 2011. Mm-hmm. So everyone wanted to do well. But it is also manifested on several other things too, that the extended family is still there. So over the young adults, there's a grandmother or grandfather still living in the household, still living in the apartment or the flat. They were able to have one child. It was a one child family. So it was one child and they all lived under one roof. Face and everyone always wants the best in that organization, in that world. So getting in the best preschool for the kid is important. And that also brings prestige to the parents. You being fresh out of university or college, you get a job in a good organization, you becoming a manager real quickly is good in that organization, in that world. Even though you haven't even coded for a year or 2 years, mm-hmm. you are expected to be a manager. Yes, you have to deal with all that stuff. Yes, you have to work with it. There are other cultures things there too. It's kind of like the cultural revolution that in that organization, like here in the States, I work really hard to make sure people I'm approachable and can talk to me and they can tell me about problems. In the Chinese culture, they necessarily won't tell you about problems because something called the cultural revolution, if you have problems or whatever, you kind of went out into the rice paddies and fields and same type thing. So they don't necessarily tell you about that. So as a leader, you got to have good checks and balances. I would still do the normal interpersonal relationship with the various people and so forth. But then also I would have strong KPIs and metrics and would measure almost everything in the organization for when things got out of alignment, I could understand something wasn't right and I needed to go in and investigate. Because over here, it wasn't that they weren't trying to hide it. They weren't being deceitful. I want you to understand that. Mm-hmm. But maybe they just don't bring it up. And they just might try to solve it themselves for a longer period of time than they should go do it type thing. So having to understand that culture was good. And I made mistakes. I think it's important to understand leaders make mistakes. Mm-hmm. I remember... probably one of the hottest jobs market I ever saw was Shanghai outside of I had about 1,000 people and they outside the doors every afternoon would be people from other organizations handing out open job position flyers to our people leaving the facility and so forth. And I had a lot of open positions and I had people on the bench and that's kind of another story. But, you know, as an American executive, we're going to figure this one out. Everyone's free at lunch, 12 o'clock. We're going to go have a meeting and we're going to figure this out. Lunch is important to the young people. It's very much a collaborative talking type culture. And so I made mistakes and I did not endear myself to the organization. But out of it, by doing the right things and the right incentives, understanding the culture, we were developing code that was 70% defect free. I'd give it to you for any period of time. I don't care if it was a font, radio button, whatever it was, how small, it would be right. Because we had really solid governance, beliefs, norms about quality. And we focused a lot on not mandating quality, but how do we get quality in? So it was a software quality assurance, an SQA approach to software quality and system quality as compared to a test approach into quality.
Thanks for sharing that personal experience that you face when you're in China. And one thing that we like about having executives like yourself on the Ivy podcast is, you know, people talk about their failures, their lessons learned, and how those have shaped them to be better leaders, you know, long-term. So thanks for sharing that. Over the past year, while dealing with the disruptive implications from the COVID-19 pandemic, CIOs have had to continually play a central role and reevaluate operations to ensure they're focusing on more strategic priorities. Right. What are some of the factors that have enabled you to be resilient during this tough period? And what advice do you have for those leaders that may still be facing challenges on how to effectively execute on technology strategies post-pandemic?
Mm. Yeah, I get that. Ask that question a fair amount. And I would tell you, it hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. Say, what do you mean it hasn't changed? Your organization was greatly impacted. The industry was greatly impacted. And I go, yeah. So when I went to Friendly's, it was not a big team. It was a good size, but not big. And they had not done a lot with technology over the years. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of things that need to be fixed and changed. And so, but how do you go, the proverbial, how do you eat the elephant? But it is one bite at a time. But you got to know where you want to bite first. And for me, it's always been IT is an enabler to improve the business through revenue generation. And so when I first got there, we put in delivery services. They didn't want to do it at first. They want to put it in. And then I said, hey, we need to do revenue management, yield management, start looking at demand forecasting and analytics and things of that nature. Oh, by the way, we need to start taking a very much of an e-commerce approach to the sites and get good placement, good, you know, views on it and watch this like a separate business. Uh-huh. So that when COVID hit, we had to do some cleanup, but we did not have to, as a restaurant company, like a lot of them, we did not have to close. In fact, we only went down about 65%. That sounds like a lot, but for a lot of restaurant companies, they went down tremendously. A lot of hotel companies, they went down a lot further.
Right.
We were able to fight our way back to only being down 35%. And then when the dining room started to open up in limited capacity, we were only down 10% in October. And it's by focusing on the revenue. So really my philosophy has not changed. It's always revenue takes priority. So you have lots of things to work on. Yep, everyone gets it. You never have enough money, never have enough resources. You always have a lot of customers that are demanding. Their project is the highest priority. And you'll get them into some type of governance, depending on what the organization culture is, some type of governance, to where you can look at all the different projects and all the different requirements, and you say which ones have the highest ROI. And it's just that simple. And then from that, you go, here are all the projects that we have on the books. Here are the ones with the highest ROI. We're going after these first. And that's the way it was initially. That's the way it's been for years. And that's the way I handled it during the pandemic. And that's the way I would handle it coming out of the pandemic, that is always how you should drive it. I hear so many organizations talk about, what's your big IT initiative? Our big IT initiative is we're moving to the cloud. And you kind of scratch your head and say, well, that's good, but that's a commodity-based play. What are you doing to improve the revenue for the company? There are a lot of great things out there. Machine learning, AI, things of that nature that can really improve the revenue for the company. That's where you need to go. You know, it's funny that Friendly's, just to be honest with you, was always this great New England brand that everyone knows has been struggling over the years. The CEO did a great job with a new menu, and that really got the customers there. But it wasn't until we got profitable, and then the operators on the other side of the table said, you know why we're profitable? And I go, I kind of know, but you know, you don't really say. You go, no, what's wrong? He says, delivery. Delivery made us profitable. And so that old beleaguered IT team went from being the group that was in the corner to now being a strategic imperative to the organization by focusing on revenue generating systems.
That's very insightful. And hopefully for all our listeners that are paying attention to that point, IT should be focused more on what they can do to help as an enabler to increase their revenue. So that's actually a very good example that you shared with us, especially on how Friendly's didn't face a tremendous drop in revenue during the pandemic based on some of the things that you guys did. So that's wonderful to hear. When it comes to innovation, especially during the current times, what strategies and methodologies do you employ that consistently help you come up with innovative ways to solve new challenges that you and your teams face for your products or services?
Interesting question. I think first is you got to say, what is innovation? Everyone thinks innovation is the penultimate project that's going to innovate the entire company. You know, you kind of go, yeah, it is, but you ain't got the capital for it. Probably don't have the appetite for a high risk project like that. Need servers, and the CEO wants this, and the other guy wants this, and you got this idea of the penultimate project. Well, it's probably not going to happen. So I believe that innovation is extremely important, but I innovate at multiple different levels. Uh-huh. And the multiple level is I encourage the team to innovate, because innovation very easily could just be to the infrastructure desktop support guy, he's going to put video cameras on all the desktops so that people can use Teams and can collaborate better. To the infrastructure person, it was get them out of desktops and into laptops. And when that had, that's actually a true story. When I got there, everything was on a desktop, an old PC on the floor, and we got them into laptops. So when COVID hit, we only had to roll out 7 laptops. Everyone else was already mobile. You know, it took us 18 months to get there. So I allow that to go do that. The departments can go innovate. And I encourage them to work with their different departments on the innovation. It's not necessarily great, but they can go get ideas. Don't ever think that your idea is the best idea. You're the worst idea. You know, the last guy to know anything in the organization is the CIO. Your frontline guys know a lot more than you do. So I'm always talking to HR. I'm always talking to ops. I'm always talking to the finance guys. What do they need? What's on their list? I always have my list of potential projects ready to go that will help out, and we can tie in the revenue to it and so forth. But I encourage the entire organization to innovate. I encourage you to prototype quickly and limitedly. So I'm not afraid to go, hey, you need some, you know, tablets to go test out a new product or a new thing. Yeah, here it is. Go do it. $200. Easy peasy. Oh, finance hasn't approved it. Yeah, I know. They're all going to get all over me for that. But go do it and go give it a try. But also, I don't just want to do it from a technology point of view. You got to do it from a business process point of view. And in that business process, how do we make more money or improve and so forth? And if it doesn't work, that's quite okay, right? Because the question is, what did we learn from it? And so some real stories are, we had a new product and we wanted to do instead of the old fashioned way of taking an order, we kind of take an order via tablet. And technology worked, had some bugs in it, but we got it to go work. We did all the content and the modifications for it. We had good training, we rolled it out. Found out we had technology issues in the restaurants, got all that solved and so forth. And then we rolled the tablets out. We were able to improve table turn time by 25%. As soon as you place your order, it would go right into the kitchen, the KDS, and he would fire it just like that. It would be on your table in about 3 minutes. Technically, it worked great. We ran into problems. And the problems were the younger generation would love tablets. They would be happy taking aware of it. But I had servers that have worked for Friendly's for 40 years. The technology modification was not easy to them, and they kind of revolted back a little bit, and they ended up throwing tablets in the trash can because they didn't like it so much. It was an utter failure. We never did it again. Our learning there was we have an older demographic. So yeah, we all knew that, but we didn't really understand how it would impact the technology. And we never went that route again. We always did a above the store type technology solution to improve the business.
Wow, what an example. And that goes to change management. A lot of companies face that because just because the technology may be solving a problem, you got to understand the people side. And that's a perfect example of why that needs to be taken into consideration.
Now, I'm a big fan of go try it and prototype. I mean, go prototype something. And prototype, you know, everyone goes for this solution will work. Well, I'll guarantee you that solution will not work. Yeah, I'll get you to 90% there, 85%, but then you'll need to do some spinning up to get it better and so forth. So go prototype it. Take those requirements that you understand really well and go prototype. Go do a limited release and understand the learnings. Another one we did was that was interesting was right now drive-throughs are really hot, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so forth. So a lot of locations don't have a drive-through and you don't have the money for a drive-through. So it's a lot of put the lanes in and modify, it's a lot of money. And so we tried a virtual drive-through where you put a parking spot outside to go do this. And we normally see anywhere between 20 to 25% of our revenue at a restaurant is drive-through. So we wanted to get something that was comparable to that. So I'm also a big believer that on a project team, it's just not the technology guys, but you have the business guys, in this case, you have the marketing guys. You also have got the, you also got accounting because they got to do all the books and so forth when all the revenue comes in and attribute it appropriately and so forth. So I like to have a really good cross-functional project team. We rolled this thing out real quickly, rolled it out in 4 weeks. Good marketing, good technology worked great. Yeah, everything, the store did a fantastic job of training and getting people to go do, to be able to support the product very well. The issue was the customer uptake wasn't that high. So instead of 20% or so, we were only averaging around 4 to 5%. So from that though, everything worked beautifully. From that though, we just, instead of a lot of marketing and signage, we had a lot of signage at the restaurant and so forth, we cut the implementation cost back. And then that became a positive ROI, easier to roll out, and it became effective. But we also had a lower expectations as to what the revenue of this was going to be in the restaurant.
Great. When hiring for your teams, do you tend to get creative with your interviews? And if so, what do you look for in the candidate responses?
I do. Interviewing is really tough. And I've, of course, made some, like we all have, I brought some people on teams that probably weren't necessarily good hires. Others of them have been extremely good hires. I do try to get creative in the interview. I chew in that 1 hour or 2 hours, whatever it might be, of getting to know somebody. I try to really understand them. And yeah, you got to start out with the proverbial interviewing questions. Tell me about yourself. What about this? What about that? But to a good interviewer, those are all stock answers. He knows them. And if he's not, he's out automatically, right? You didn't prepare. You don't know me. You don't know the people in my organization. You didn't prepare. That's a big check against you, right? Because I always like people that prepare, and that way you can solve problems better if you prepare for things. But I try to get them out of this comfort zone of the typical interviewer, and I try to drive them into a really insecure area. So I normally ask a question like, what's the tire pressure of a 747 airplane? And then I do what I just did there is I let them hang. And it's not so much that they know the specific answer, but it's how they think through it. So he says, I said, I don't know. I said, that's fine. Don't expect you to know everything. What do you think? And then he goes, well, I think this. And then I'll peel the onion back another layer. And I go, why? And then you start, when you start doing this, you really start getting to see how they think. So let me try with you. What is the tire pressure of a 747 tire?
I would probably say somewhere around 700 PSI. Hmm. And the reason I would come up with that is because I have a bike and I've had two bikes. One was taking 40. The one that I currently have is taking 60, but it has a bigger wheel wall. So given the size of the wheel wall over 747 tire, I just projected that by, let's say, 10X.
Yeah. Okay. So 10X, fine. What does that tire have to do as compared to your bike tire?
It has to withstand a lot of pressure and force while landing the aircraft. So that has to make sure that the PSI in there can help support and withstand that so that the tires don't fail during the landing process or even takeoff.
That's right. So you actually have a good train of thought. A lot of people don't know. How would you find out what the tire pressure is? This has actually changed over the years. Back in the early 2000s, there was no Google.
Right.
Most people now will say, I'll go Google it. And that's very much acceptable to go find information about a subject you're trying to tackle, very much. But the actual answer is it's actually fairly low pressure. That's why you have so many of them on there. The reason that it is low pressure is just what you actually brought it up is landing. Because they take this heavy aircraft as it is descending and it's got to be able to absorb the load. So the tire has got to be able to give and flex. So it will really flex during that time period to absorb the load. Whereas your bike tire doesn't have a lot of give in it. You hit a bad bump, you're gonna blow the tube on the tire. That's right. And so on. So for this, it's actually very large. But it doesn't matter what the answer is. It's, I got a chance to see Fred think.
That's
Fred does great at podcasts. He does great at other things. I just put him into an area and I get a chance to say, well, he's got some actual logic behind what he's doing. He's comparing it to a bike tire. He's comparing it to this. He has some thought as to what he is thinking. He's just not saying in here in front of me saying, I'm a great coder. So
that's good. That's good. And for our listeners, they may be interviewing with Pete. You just got an insight onto what kind of questions that you need to prepare for.
Oh, you'll probably get one or two like that. That's right. And it's not a right or wrong answer. It's about how do you think is the, give me some insight into who you really are versus the stoic interviewing responses.
Right. And sticking with the interviewing aspect, what are some of the attributes that you found to be ideal when hiring for leadership positions within your vertical?
Genuine. I like genuine leaders. I like leaders that say, didn't go well. I can take that, believe it or not. I don't like to be caught flat-footed, but I understand things don't happen. And I can take that. And then we as an organization need to understand why and improve upon it. So I think one of the best traits is genuine. The other thing that I think is really important is being an interpersonal leader. You don't necessarily have to be a subject matter expert, but you've got to be subject matter knowledgeable. The other thing that I often tell folks is, you know, when you get up to a certain point, you don't know the answers. Fred doesn't know all the answers. Pete doesn't know all the answers. But I expect my leaders to be able to ask the right thought-provoking questions to make sure that it de-risks the problem effectively so that we are successful. That's what I expect out of you. So that's when I am looking for folks on that. Yes, you got to know what you're talking about. Yes, you got to be knowledgeable. But more importantly, you got to be a genuine leader. Are you going to be the guy that's going to be there when everything hits the fan? And I don't want your hands on the keyboard. I want you providing leadership to the team that this is what we need to go do, but this is how we're gonna get through it. And we're gonna be successful if we go do this type thing. And that's what is important. And often, if you look at my background, people ask me, says, I graduated with a degree in human relations. And they say, wow, you're not an engineer. And I said, no. I'm an engineer by trade and not training. And they go, well, you gotta have to know that. I said, I got news for you. They said, what's that? That degree in human relations is probably one of the best bang on degrees you can have in technology. And it kind of always blows the HR guy's mind. I go, poof, what do you mean? And I says, systems don't build themselves yet. Systems don't repair themselves yet. Technology is a people game. And we're back to that leadership point. When things go wrong, are you the good enough leader that the whole team wants to stay there that night and solve the problem? Are they good enough that they're not going to quit until the business is back up and online? And it's not yelling and screaming, and we got to go do this. You're not committed or loyal or whatever. It's that you've created this leadership and this culture that they're going to come in and they're going to solve this problem. They're not going to take second place. That's what I expect out of my leaders.
There's something that you touched on earlier about advanced technologies, and I was going to ask you, the use of advanced methodologies such as AI, machine learning, and deep learning are on the rise across different organizations. What practical advice do you have for teams and organizations that are just now getting started on implementing AI strategies?
One is you got to learn what AI is. AI is going to go down as one of these big buzzwords in the technology industry one more time, right behind big data, IPv6, and all these revolutionary changing type technologies. AI is very important, but don't forget that AI in the early 2000s was the horizon of HR back then, artificial intelligence back then was optical character reading. Okay, and that has been solved. So if you go talk to the hardcore data scientists and people like that, they say AI is really stuff that hasn't been solved. However, besides that anecdotal story on the side there, what is important is that you got to understand what it can do and can't go do. AI is nothing more than algorithms and statistics based on information coming into it, looking for signals, whether it be textual, whether it be LIDAR coming in off of a car or whatever it might be, just tons and tons of data and processing it. And that's a very simple approach to it. There's a lot more to it, but you got to understand that stuff. So let's go back and look at analytics are extremely important. Predictive analytics is extremely important. If you understand predictive analytics, you can get into deep learning. Deep learning is really neural networks. That you understand what the middle layer does with the neural networks of deep analytics. And then you have machine learning and being able to put all this stuff together, which can be nothing more than a composite of algorithms of a lot of different algorithms operating and so forth. So I actually am very bullish on the area. I'm bullish really on predictive analytics. And then from that is deep learning. Machine learning is okay, but doing the predictive analytics is really important. You'll find a lot of organizations are real happy to operate off of an Excel spreadsheet. They don't have the culture for this. They don't necessarily want to take capital and risk on something that may not work out, but I want to encourage you to go do it. So then your question also is, how do you go do it? And so I like to go back to find something that has fair amount of value in the organization and then do a low risk project, two or three folks, prototyping it, see if it can go work, see what the results are. Does it work? Yes. An old Stoic restaurant, Friendly's, we put in revenue management and yield management models, looking at demand, forecasting demand. What can you go do with pricing? Is there season? I mean, everyone knows there's seasonality in ice cream in the summer. All the industry guys know that. Everyone knows that. But how much? How much do you take your price up before you break demand? Start working those models, and you'll start having much better conversations inside the organizations. So with Friendly's, it was we went up 15% off to offset the delivery costs on products that went to the homes. That's great. And the question I always ask is before we started getting into statistics with the organization was, all right, you went up your hamburger from $8 to $13 as it went home. Why not $13.25? Why not $13.50? When does demand break? How can you make this better viable product? So for us, what is digital transformation? That's another big buzzword. No one really knows what it is. But for us, it's clearly defined as a system of systems that generate the right product to the right customer at the right time, at the right price point, which is technology, analytics, business, marketing, and so forth to be successful.
Final question for you. And
yes, sir.
We have a set of listeners that are recent college grads, MBA grads, and this question is normally geared towards people like that or people that are looking to transition into new professions. Sure. What has helped you to get to where you are? And what of advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's similar to yours?
Couple of things. One is work. Don't be afraid of work. Don't be afraid. The other one is don't stop learning. Don't stop applying what you learn. So what I often find in careers are people will do their job. I'm a Java guy and I code Java. All right, that's great. So what are you doing to improve yourself? What are you learning? I got family, I got this. And yeah, I get all those commitments, but what are you doing to learn? And they go, and then something happens. They don't like the ball, so they leave or whatever. And then they become your career is dictated by opportunities versus you dictating your career. And I encourage you to know what you want to go do. And the learning just isn't necessarily learning to code better. That is good. But learning about the people around you, learning about the business, learning about new things, HR. I'm a big Harvard Business Review guy. I read all the time. I listen to podcasts like that. Some of the stuff is absolutely terrible. Some of the nuggets are really good. Some of those nuggets really help save a company. And I went back to try and apply a few things. So I read a book a long time ago about, strategic HR, and you don't have all the money in the world. So how do you invest your money into the right areas of your part of the business? Well, what are the ones that have the highest return on investment? Those are the ones you want to go do, put the money into. The other ones are commodity type plays and don't necessarily, aren't going to generate a lot for you. So that's pretty good. So I've been able to apply that in some areas. But I was running this Chinese outsourcing company. I had 20% of my people on the bench, 20% of open headcount. So I was off by 40%. What do you go do? So you kind of go, well, that's kind of interesting. We're really messed up here. Company hasn't grown in 3 years. So what do? We wrote a predictive model that looked at how quickly could I hire somebody, could get that information right out of the HR system. Where could I get the most money if I had it on the system? What was the highest ROI? I mean, if it took me a long time to get it and I could sell it really quickly, well, we take a chance on that guy and we hire him in. Okay. If I can hire a Java person off the street within 5 days, well, I'm not going to put him on the bench and pay him and not have any return on that position. So we could figure out ROI. I could look across by the sector of my skill sets, what was my retention rate? So I could figure out demand for what I needed in those areas. And then from that, we could also tweak it up and down a little bit, i.e. bonuses coming out, bonuses not coming out. People always stick for bonus. They always leave after bonus and it goes up a certain amount. We put all that into the predictive model. We would run it every month. My biggest buying decision was labor in an IT services company. And so from that, we were able to get, I think we got the headcount, open headcount down to about 5 headcount and only like a small number of people on the bench. But more important to me was that the customer came to me one time and said, we're really impressed that you can hire 30 people in about 2 weeks. You know, really? That's pretty interesting. I never thought of it that way. But where I got it from was my reading from the HR book a long time ago and just saying, let's try putting that in a model. They had a rudimentary model over there. Let's try putting a model over here and see. Go to put the hours in and see if it works for us. Oh, it worked 85, 90%. Well, that's pretty good. It's not 100%, but it's 90%. Let's try it. Let's base our buying 1 month off of that. And we did. So it was the guy that ran the algorithm, HR, so forth. We'd meet every month, the CFO, because it was a big decision. I always bring him in, say, this is it. That little learning of HR helped save Dangon Company. The stuff I learned in hotels was applied to Friendly. So never stop learning in your career, because we'll probably have some opportunity for you later on. And I find so many people, they do their basic thing and they do their job, but they stop growing. And that's the biggest thing to having a good career, is continue to grow. The other thing is don't be afraid of taking on the new job. Yeah, you want those messed up situations. Yeah, you want to improve it. Yeah, you want to be the go-to guy to get it fixed. Yeah, it's going to take you a lot of hours and it's going to hurt a little bit. But those are the guys that get the opportunities as you go through your career, not the guys that leave on a safe game.
Great. Don't stop learning. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today, Pete. This has been really fascinating.
Thanks, Fred. Have a good day.
You as well.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.